Move to the third case this morning, Etherly v. Schwartz.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, and may it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carl Treble, and I represent the Respondent Warden on behalf of Illinois. The State Appellate Court reasonably balanced a number of factors. On one hand, there was little, if any, police coercion before Petitioner confessed. Petitioner was read, acknowledged, and waived his Miranda rights. He never asked for counsel, a parent, or other friendly adult. He was a gang member, and Petitioner's father was notified of the questioning, and a passive youth officer was present during his initial questioning and when he made a written confession to the assistant state's attorney. On the other hand, Petitioner was 15 years old. A police officer had told him that if he cooperated, they would tell the judge of his cooperation. He was illiterate and having problems in school, and had been described as having borderline intelligence, and he had no criminal history personally, although he was a gang member. Now, the Supreme Court has clearly established that both juvenile and adult confessions are evaluated under the general totality of the circumstances test, and Petitioner's confession can only be involuntary where it's shown that his will was overborne. The State Court reasonably applied this test. To prevail in federal court, Petitioner must show that the State Court's decision was the result of an objectively unreasonable application of the totality of the circumstances test. And the Supreme Court has described 28 U.S.C. 2254 as a deferential lens through which the state court's decision is evaluated. But where the Supreme Court has announced only a very general test, such as the totality of the circumstances test, then Knowles and Yarbrough teach us that state courts have even greater leeway in their case-by-case determinations.
Now, the petitioner does suggest at page 37 of his brief that you are really arguing for a rule that says that any time the state has to weigh relevant factors, as you do in a voluntariness test, that a federal court really is precluded from saying that the resulting determination is unreasonable. Are you arguing for such a rule?
No, Your Honor. We reject that straw man argument in our reply brief. We're not saying that it's...
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. We're not saying that a state court could just protect its decision and insulate itself from federal review by simply stating that it applied the totality of the circumstances test. But you have to find an objective sign that that state court's decision falls with, as this court described it, well outside the bounds of reasonable differences of opinion. In our research, we could only identify the four cases in the Court of Appeals that we cite in our reply brief as examples where a state court had gone outside those bounds. And they include cases of extreme police coercion, like in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals case Lamb, where the police had dressed up as violent Asian gang members and gone into the petitioner's place of business and threatened her with her life. The state court had acknowledged that, but then didn't apply it with any force in its decision. That case shows that you can't just insulate yourself by stating you're following the totality of the circumstances.
So I suppose one possible way by which a state court opinion could be unreasonable would be if it completely ignored one of the factors that, under the case law, a court needs to consider. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what happened in the Ninth Circuit case Taylor v. Maddox, one of the four cases we identified. And it's something that the Supreme Court has touched on but never applied in any of its cases. But where the state court in Taylor had completely failed to acknowledge the fact that there was corroborating testimony by the petitioner's attorney that he had gone through a late-night interrogation, and had requested to see counsel, had never been provided that opportunity, and the state court just completely disregarded that factor and didn't even talk about it, then its decision was objectively unreasonable. But even, and we're not saying that even where a court applies all of the relevant factors, it couldn't be objectively unreasonable. And those are the examples like Lamb and a couple of other cases like the Ninth Circuit case Duty, where the state courts did acknowledge all of the relevant factors, but then just completely misapplied them because there was much more police coercion in those cases than what the state court had been willing to acknowledge.
Now, your opposing counsel suggests that here the state court really didn't give adequate attention at all to the topic of the petitioner's mental acuity. What's your reply to that?
Well, the problem with that analysis, Your Honor, is that state courts are not required to tell us exactly how much weight they're giving to a specific factor. And his argument seems to be, well, they only briefly discussed his lack of intelligence and therefore didn't adequately apply it. And it's important to remember that under the deferential lens of 2254, we have to find guidance in United States Supreme Court authority. We've identified a number of lower court cases where people with IQs of 80 or with severely inadequate intelligence have made voluntary confessions, and those show that the state court's decision in this case was not objectively unreasonable. This court's acknowledged in the past that lower court decisions can't be forced upon the state courts, but those lower court decisions do show where they've ruled similarly under similar circumstances that these state court's decision was objectively reasonable. Also, most of the evidence that came out regarding petitioner's illiteracy went to the fact that he could not read and write. And in here, the Miranda warnings were given to him verbally, and he verbally acknowledged them. And the police officers weren't overreaching by providing him a written form in order to take advantage of his illiteracy. So that is not a factor showing that the state court was objectively unreasonable. The state court reasonably applied the totality of the circumstances, and reasonable jurists might disagree on how much weight to give the fact that he had a lower than average intelligence, but their ultimate decision balancing against the other factors, such as the fact that he was read his Miranda rights and the fact that there was no police coercion, shows that the state court's decision did not fall outside the permissible bounds of differences of opinion.
Feel somewhat better about it if the youth officer had at times intervened and tried to explain a little bit more what the detectives immediately had told the petitioner, but perhaps in terms that difficult for a young man with this particular disability to understand.
Right. And the issue of how youth officer factors should be treated in these cases has never percolated to the U.S. Supreme Court, so we don't have any guidance. It's something that is specific to Illinois law. Illinois law requires that a youth officer be notified anytime a juvenile is being interrogated. And even the courts approving of the passive presence in Illinois of the youth officer have held that he has a prophylactic duty. He has a duty to make sure the petitioner's parents are notified, that the petitioner is Mirandized, that petitioner has an opportunity to use the restroom and gets food and water, and that there's no police coercion taking effect. So although this court in Hardaway criticized a state appellate court, an Illinois court's discussion of the youth officer factor, it's important to note that Illinois courts are not saying the youth officer is supplementing or replacing the role of a friendly adult, as is discussed in cases like Gallegos, pre-Miranda cases like that. It's not that this youth officer is there to act as an advocate for...
He's there only as an observer.
He's a passive observer. That's right, Your Honor. And
if he did intrude himself into the business, he'd be shut off.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
So if he did intrude himself into the business, he'd be shut off.
Yes, Your Honor. And the officer, the detectives investigating the felony murder, they waited until the youth officer was present before they began questioning the petitioner in this case.
False as a criminal income is required that an attorney be present during the lineup. He doesn't get to say anything. He's just there to obviate a bad finger.
That's right, Your Honor. That is another good example of how someone, even in a passive presence, plays a prophylactic role. I think that's a good analogy. And it, again, it's something specific to Illinois where the U.S. Supreme Court just hasn't offered us guidance. And the Supreme Court, even with the friendly adult context, has never clearly established that a friendly adult must be present. This court talked about that in Gilbert v. Merchant, where it said, we just can't hold a state court's treatment of that issue as being objectively unreasonable, where the Supreme Court has never breathed new life into the youth officer, or excuse me, the friendly adult factor.
May I ask one other question of you, sir, that has bothered me in this case? Some of our cases talk about the obligation of state courts to show, quote, extra care, unquote, when we are dealing with the voluntariness of a juvenile's confession. First of all, what is the constitutional status of that language? What role does it play analytically? And secondly, how do you believe it was manifested in this particular case?
Your Honor, that language arose in Supreme Court decisions where they were making a discussion, and therefore our argument is simply dicta and not a clear holding of how juveniles should be basically informed of their right to counsel and their right to remain silent. For the most part, well, really, those were all pre-Miranda cases. In re Gault came out, I think, the year after Miranda, but the factual scenario with which it dealt came out pre-Miranda. Those cases all dealt with how do we alert juveniles to these rights that exist. One of the options they discussed was having a friendly adult, but Miranda ultimately concluded, as seen in the case Fair v. Michael C., that you simply have to inform both juveniles and adults that they have certain constitutional rights. You mentioned that this court has several times repeated that language, which again we say is dicta, in discussing these issues, but it's important to remember that this court's decisions are not authoritative on the state courts. Until there's U.S. Supreme Court language breathing new life into that special care language, then you can't say that the state court's application of it was objectively unreasonable, particularly where the Supreme Court's never said what it meant when it stated special care. Moreover,
our cases just simply represent our best efforts to figure out what they did mean, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And the state courts are entitled, through federalism and comity, to make their best effort to decide what that means. For example, in this case, the state appellate court not only looked at the factors that are relevant in adult confessions, but also looked at what Illinois courts have described as important relevant factors for juvenile confessions, such as the petitioner's age and whether or not a youth officer was present, which again is a requirement specific to Illinois law. And I'm sorry, yes, and unless there are any further questions right now, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Case.
May it please the court. Eris Etherly was 15 years old. He'd had no prior experience with the police. He had significant issues with intellectual functioning, such that he did not even know how to properly write his own name. There was no concerned adult present for any of his interrogation. And the key event in his questioning occurred when a uniformed officer took Eris alone into a police station bathroom and there persuaded him to make inculpatory statements to the police. In these circumstances, the Illinois appellate court's conclusion that Eris' statements were voluntary was objectively unreasonable. The Illinois appellate court purported to apply the totality of the circumstances test, and that meant the court had to look at, first, Eris' characteristics, who he was, what were his characteristics, his personal vulnerabilities, and then, in light of those vulnerabilities, examine the circumstances of the interrogation. And, okay, so who was Eris? He was, as I said, 15. Now, there is no question that this is an age that triggers more careful scrutiny of the circumstances of an interrogation than would be applied to an adult. This was not dicta from Supreme Court cases. This is clear holdings from Gault, Gallegos, Haley. It has never been overruled or questioned. This court has echoed it multiple times in Hardaway and AM and other cases. So there is no question of law as to whether the Illinois Appellate Court was required to apply special care to the circumstances of the interrogation here. There is no evidence, not a shred of evidence in the record, that Aris had any contact with the police before this interrogation. The state mentioned several times that he was a gang member, and the state is relying on Aris's court-reported statement where he says he's in a gang. There's no indication in the record of what that really means. Was he some kind of ranking member who had undergone a formal initiation, or was he just a kid who was hanging out with guys who were in a gang? We just don't know. What we do know is that he had never been arrested, and there's just no evidence that he had any contact with the police. And as was discussed a moment ago, there is tremendous evidence in the record of an impaired intellectual functioning. Aris was failing all of his classes in school. He'd been in special ed since the second grade. The state's own psychiatrist diagnosed him with borderline intellectual functioning, which really means exactly what it says. And he was completely illiterate. On his court-reported statement, he couldn't write his own name. He misspelled every word more than three letters. And I want to be clear what that means. It's not so much that he couldn't read or write. It's that he obviously had had a problem learning how to read or write. He's 15 years old. He's in high school. He'd been in special ed since a young age. He had a tutor in all of his classes, and he still hadn't grasped the most basic concepts of literacy. What this suggests is a severe learning disability and intellectual impairment.
But yet he was influenced, you say, by this police officer's simple statement that he had a moral obligation to say where the weapons were. He grasped that, did he, to you?
I'm sorry?
Your view is he grasped that when he was told.
Well, it's important to remember the circumstances in which those statements occurred. It's not so much that a police officer told him he had to tell the truth or that it would go better for him if he told the truth. It's that these statements were made to Aris by a uniformed officer in a police station bathroom. Aris was 15, he had no experience with the police, impaired mental acuity, alone in a bathroom with the officer. No youth officer, no lawyer, nobody was present, just the two of them. And this is a situation which appears designed to have enhanced Aris's feelings of vulnerability and powerlessness.
Yet the police, the detective later did clarify the situation and make it clear that if he wanted to tell them where the guns were, that was fine, but he had to understand that all they could do was tell the judge of his cooperation.
It's not clear whether Aris understood that or whether he understood that the police were going to help him. There's no indication either way, and given his impaired mental acuity.
So this conversation you and I are having about what he understood and what he did understand, is that really what we need to worry about up here? It seems to me, so far your oral argument has been very articulate argument about your client's plight, but the question we come down to is, why are we not obligated to defer to the state courts and their determination that this was in fact a voluntary situation?
I agree.
And in your brief, you are very articulate about that and talk about how this balancing test and that we still have some role to play. What role do we have to play?
The role here is to look at what the Illinois Appellate Court did with this evidence. What was its analysis, and did it make errors in analyzing the factors of the totality of the circumstances
test? What's the silver bullet for you? Where did they mess up?
Basically, three errors. First, failing to appreciate the significance of this bathroom interrogation.
Well, you have a problem there because it wasn't egregious by any means, was it?
Well, in these circumstances, I believe it was.
Asking that he has more responsibility to tell the truth is egregious?
Well, this is what the state court did, is they focused only on that statement and ignored the circumstances in which those statements were made.
He was in a bathroom.
Okay.
With a uniformed officer.
the totality of the circumstances. 15-year-old kid, no experience with the police, impaired mental functioning.
That doesn't cut either way, though, does it? No experience with the police, good or bad?
The appellate court ignored the significance of that factor by reasoning that he must have understood that under Miranda he had the option of not talking to the police. And that's the bathroom interrogation kind of shows the flaw in that reasoning. With who Aris was, his lack of experience, his impaired mental acuity, in that bathroom with the officer, is it reasonable to assume that he understood that he had the option of saying, no, I'm not going to talk to you? Is it reasonable to assume that he understood that the police weren't really going to help him if he talked to them? You know, is it reasonable to assume that he understood that it wasn't really going to go better
but
for
isn't
him?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir, please.
That could cut either way, and that's the problem, because that doesn't make the district or the Illinois appellate court objectively unreasonable, right?
Well, they failed to analyze that encounter as evidence of coercion. They focused only on what was said and isolated the statements that were said as if they had been said in an interrogation room with a lawyer or parent or anybody. And that's a major flaw in the court's reasoning. That was objectively unreasonable. And speaking of the presence of a youth officer, this is just an indefensible analysis by the state court. Okay, the Supreme Court has emphasized over and over again the importance that there be a concerned adult for juvenile confessions. And this court's jurisprudence with respect to a youth officer is a rulification of that well-established rule. It's not a per se rule. There's no per se rule that if there's no concerned adult, the confession is per se involuntary. But it is an important and critical factor in a totality analysis. And here, this youth officer did absolutely nothing. He came in with Detective Spencer to interrogate Aris and just sat there. He didn't explain Miranda rights to Aris. He didn't ask Aris any questions. He didn't even introduce himself. He didn't say, hi, my name is Joe. I'm here to do X. And the state court, you know, not only did not weigh that in favor of finding that Aris's statements were involuntary, but actually faulted Aris for it. He said it was Aris's responsibility to affirmatively seek help from the youth officer, as if Aris had any clue who this person was.
In your brief, you are very critical of the state court's lack of understanding, lack of appreciation, whatever word you want to use, of the mental capabilities of your client. Can we say they ignored them?
We can say that they effectively ignored it. It was mentioned, but not analyzed in any meaningful way. And look at the evidence that was in front
of
the
court. Doesn't this put a tremendous premium on just how articulate or how good a legal writer the particular state court judge is who gets this case for assignment?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as a flaw in the writing, because the court was very clear about what evidence it was relying on and what evidence it was not. The court analyzed Aris's intellectual functioning only by cherry-picking one sentence out of Dr. Pan's report. This was the state psychiatrist who had an ultimate conclusion that there's no evidence that Aris did not understand Miranda. But this is the same report that diagnosed Aris with borderline intellectual functioning, and there's a real tension between those two conclusions. There's also this temporal tension where Dr. Pan is stating, is evaluating Aris in the present tense, saying that he understands X and knows Y. Therefore, a year and a half ago, he understood X and knew Y. That just doesn't add up. This was a juvenile who's a year and a half older, had been in juvenile detention, presumably had, you know, picked up some knowledge of Miranda and custodial interrogations. So given these weaknesses in Dr. Pan's report, it was unreasonable for the state court to have relied exclusively on that report and disregarded all the other evidence of Aris's impaired intellectual functioning. The trouble he had just learning basic phonics, for instance, in juvenile detention, it took him 5 months and he hadn't even gotten through the alphabet, just the basic concepts of associating words with letters or sounds with letters. I mean, this was obviously a kid with impaired intellectual functioning, and the state court just kind of swept all that aside and ignored that evidence in favor of cherry-picking this one conclusion out of Dr. Pan's report.
Mr. Case, we're getting short on time, and I do have one other question from your brief, if I may. Your brief, as I understood it, disputes the fact that after the Galt case, voluntariness is necessarily the sole touchstone for the admissibility of the confession of a juvenile. I quite frankly don't understand the basis for that statement in your brief, or what you would substitute for that state, for the voluntariness standard. Could you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. The point of that part of the brief was to respond to the state's criticism of the district court's decision. The district court had said it was basically not clear whether a showing coercion was required for juveniles. Our argument in the brief and my argument here is that this court doesn't need to reach that issue. Here there was evidence of coercion that the state court missed, and it was objectively unreasonable for them to have missed the course of circumstances of the bathroom conversation. So whether or not a showing of coercion is per se required for juveniles is just not an issue this court need decide. Now, the state has emphasized the deferential standard.
The coercion is a conversation in the bathroom.
I'm sorry?
The conversation in the bathroom.
The bathroom encounter was the coercion. I would not characterize it as a conversation, however. This was not an officer escorting Aris into the bathroom so that he could just use the restroom. This was a deliberate effort to persuade Aris to make inculpatory statements to the police. And it occurred outside any constitutional safeguards. And it was an inherently coercive atmosphere. Even under the deferential standard of review, and we recognize that, we have never disputed that, not here, not anywhere else. Federal habeas review is not a rubber stamp where the state court makes critical errors in its analysis and application of a legal test, as was the case here. Habeas relief is appropriate, and we ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Case. How much time? You have 2.5 minutes.
Your Honors, as I was saying, the state appellate court did exercise special care. They looked at specific factors relevant to juveniles, including age, education, prior criminal history, and the presence of a youth officer. As we said, it's not clear that special care is required under U.S. Supreme Court precedent, but it is clear that under Colorado v. Connolly, you must show police coercion. And the court has never held that only applies to adults, and a number of lower courts have applied Connolly in the context of juvenile confession cases. So looking at the police coercion here, petitioner makes much of the mysterious circumstances in which the uniformed police officer made that statement, but it's important to remember that the state court granted a full evidentiary hearing, and it was petitioner's burden to prove what those mysterious circumstances were. He didn't even testify. All we know about what he thinks about the coercive influence of that statement is what he said in his statement and written amendment to that statement to the assistant state's attorney. And when he did that, what he said was that the officer had told him that he had an obligation to help the police officers, and if he did so, they would let the judge know of his cooperation. And as the state appellate court noted, there was no specific benefit made. So the fact that this statement or conversation took place in a bathroom, to the extent that there was any mystery as to what happened there, it's petitioner's burden to show it. And he's asked in his briefs for...
Well, the only testimony about what was said there came from Mr. Etherwood?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How do we know what happened in the bathroom?
We know that from his transcribed statement.
His meaning
petitioner's transcribed statement to the assistant state's attorney and his written amendments to that, which were all testified to by the detectives in this case in the suppression hearing. And the facts for that are discussed both in the state appellate court and the state trial court's factual findings. Real quickly, there is no silver bullet in this case. Petitioner cannot show coercion like there was in the Lamb case, where the officers were threatening the petitioner with his life or with her life. He can't show that there was 12 hours of interrogation, or that they kept interrogating him over and over in the face of silence, as took place in the pre-EDPA Woods case that petitioner relies on in his brief. And as to Dr. Pan's report, he does state at the end of the report that he did look at contemporary evidence, and there is I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time is up. Can I finish that thought real quick? Dr. Pan's report does state that he was doing a retrospective analysis. It's true, but that's very common. Fitness hearings are often retrospective, and particularly where they rely on contemporary evidence like academic records, which is at page JA-149, at the bottom of that page, it has been held to be correct in the federal courts, and therefore the state appellate court's reliance on that could not have been objectively unreasonable. We ask that you affirm, or excuse me, we ask that you reverse the district court's decision below. Thank you.
Not used to being the appellate, are you?
Sorry?
Not used to being the appellate, are you?
Not used to there.
Well, thanks to both.